WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Don DeLillo has been called the chief shaman of the paranoid school of American fiction. That's perhaps best exemplified by his novel Libra, a fictionalized version of Lee Harvey Oswald's life. DeLillo's latest novel, Underworld, has just been published in paperback. In a New Yorker article about DeLillo, David Remnick wrote, "Many of DeLillo's old themes are in Underworld, the increasing power of the image and the media in the modern world, the uncertainty of American life after the Kennedy assassination, a sense of national danger, men and women who live outside the mainstream of ordinary life and language. There's even the whiff here and there of that most singular DeLillo trademark, paranoia." But more often, Underworld is a darkly funny satire of post-war language, manner, and obsessions. The novel begins on a day in 1951, framed by two events, the Giants winning the pennant with a surprise home run, and the Soviets testing the atom bomb. Last October, I asked DeLillo why he singled out these events. He told me that he was researching the baseball game in an edition of the New York Times from October 4, 1951, and he found the story of the bomb test.
It struck me with the force of revelation. On the front page of the Times, there was a headline on the left about this legendary, what is now a legendary ball game, Giants capture pennant, and so on. And on the right side of the front page, symmetrically matched three columns, a three-line headline, the same typeface, "Soviets explode atomic bomb." Something about the juxtaposition of these two events made me think there was something here I wanted to explore. I wasn't sure at the moment quite what. What I did feel was a sense of the power of history. And through the 5 years it took me to write the book, it began to occur to me slowly that, in fact, there is a kind of relationship between this ball game, this particular ball game, and that atomic test on the other side of the world.
What do you think the relationship is?
Well, I think that the ball game was a unifying and largely joyous event, the kind of event in which people come out of their houses in order to share their feelings with others. And an event not primarily defined by television. There was only limited coverage. With the onset of the bomb, the communal spirit becomes associated with danger and loss rather than with celebration. And the sense of catastrophic events framed and defined by TV grows ever stronger. Assassinations, terrorist acts, even natural disasters. In my private little history text, this ball game marks a kind of transitional moment between the end of World War II and the beginning of the Cold War.
You've said that murders actually draw us together. You know, you're talking about the crowd either being a crowd expressing its joy or coming together because of catastrophe. You've said murders draw us together. They draw people together in ways that only the most disastrous contemporary events can match. We depend on disaster to consolidate our vision. And there's a murder that is captured on videotape and is shown over and over and over again on television in your new book, and it's a murder by the Texas Highway Killer, who's a sniper who shoots at motorists driving by. And this is accidentally captured on tape by a girl with a video camera. I'd like you to do a reading from a passage about this. This is from your new book, Underworld. Feel free to introduce it for us before you read.
The videotape is a curious contemporary phenomenon, and it is marked in a way by repetition. Such tapes always seem to be characterized by violence or tragedy. And I've begun to get the idea that this endless repetition, the re-showing day after day of a particular tape until its power dwindles and another tape replaces it, I begin to think that this is almost our last perception of nature. That is, the violence we see on these tapes is not choreographed movie violence. It is violence in its natural state, caught in some cases accidentally, casually. And so it has a kind of base reality. It is real, it is taped, and it is shown repeatedly.
Maybe you could do the reading now.
It shows something awful and unaccompanied. You want your wife to see it because it is real this time, not fancy movie violence. The realness beneath the layers of cosmetic perception. Hurry up, Janet. Here it comes. He dies so fast. There is no accompaniment of any kind. It is very stripped. You want to tell her it is realer than real, but then she will ask what that means. The way the camera reacts to the gunshot, a startled reaction that brings pity and terror into the frame, the girl's own shock, the girl's identification with the victim. You don't see the blood, which is probably trickling behind his ear and down the back of his neck. The way his head is twisted away from the door, the twist of the head gives you only a partial profile, and it's the wrong side. It's not the side where he was hit. And maybe you're being a little aggressive here, practically forcing your wife to watch. Why? What are you telling her? Are you making a little statement, like I'm going to ruin your day out of ordinary spite? Or a big statement, like this is the risk of existing?
That's Don DeLillo reading from his new novel, Underworld. You know, the idea of watching a murder captured accidentally on tape over and over again reminds me, of course, of the Zapruder film and of the real-life TV murder of Oswald by Ruby. I mean, did you see that as it happened?
I did not see it as it happened, no. I found out about it later in the day, and I suppose that particular moment, happening only 2 days after President Kennedy himself was killed, marks a very curious transition. You know, Kennedy was killed on film. His death was a home movie. Oswald was killed on television, as if to mark the social difference between these two men. The Zapruder film became a very exclusive entity. You could not see the Zapruder film unless you were willing to pay a great deal of money to see it. It was not shown publicly in this country until the mid-1970s, whereas Oswald, on videotape, was shown repeatedly for years and years.
Did you see violence? I should mention, as our listeners know, that your earlier novel, one of your earlier novels, Libra, was about Oswald and a fictionalized version of Oswald, the Kennedy assassination, and the people investigating it. Do you see violent news as replacing theater in the American mind?
It seems to be replacing a number of things. The impact of the news seems far greater now than it used to be, and it's not necessarily substantial news. We seem to pay less and less attention to substantial news and to devote a greater amount of our energies to news that seems to have a kind of tabloid emptiness at its heart. And in a curious and very, very subjective way, I associate this with something that seems to be happening as a result of the end of the Cold War. That is that events used to be calibrated to the phenomenon of awesome Cold War conflict, even events that had no connection to the U.S. or the USSR. this curious measurability has disappeared with the end of the Cold War, and it's left a kind of vacuum in which news itself, regardless of its substance, becomes an important element in our lives.
I think it gives us something to talk about. You know, like whether we're talking about the baseball game or the latest murder, it's something we have in common with strangers that we could talk about.
Well, I suppose that's true. There is a sense in which the darker the news is, the more important it seems to be to people. It's almost as though the narrative of our time is transmitted in the form of dangerous and sometimes catastrophic news. This is the narrative that perhaps has replaced the novel in a curious sense.
My guest is Don DeLillo. His latest novel is called Underworld. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Don DeLillo, and Underworld is the name of his new novel. The first phrase in your new novel is, he speaks in your voice, American. What is American to you?
When my books were first translated into French, I was delighted to find that on the first page of the French edition, the statement that this book was translated from the American, not from the English, from the American. And I think the language I use, particularly in this novel, is the American language. Very hard to translate, in fact. And steeped in American rhythms, slang, all those special languages ranging from baseball to the slick locutions of advertising to the Italian-American slang of the Bronx. That's the language I'm referring to when I say American, and the people I'm referring to are people of diverse backgrounds, beginning with the immigrants of the early part of this century and their children.
You've had to go back to some of the nouns of the 50s, you know, certain products and styles and ad slogans, foods that we don't eat anymore. Were there words that you rediscovered in writing Underworld that you found to be particularly evocative of the period?
One of the pleasures of this book was rediscovering the language of the 1940s and 1950s. I'm not sure I can cite particular words, but when I tried to reconstruct the street argot of my own background in the Bronx, one of the curious pleasures of this endeavor was figuring out spellings for such strange words, words that in many cases I don't think ever found a life outside those narrow neighborhoods.
Such as?
Well, there's a curious word, brouch, which I've never heard spoken anywhere outside the Italian Bronx. And the word means to welsh on a debt, essentially. If you say to me, you owe me $20, DeLillo, I say to you, it's a brouch. This means you're not getting it. Where does this word come from? Well, I think it comes from an Italian word that means to burn. In other words, I am burning you for this money. But I've never heard it since I was 17 years old.
I believe both your parents were Italian immigrants, and I'm wondering if they spoke Italian a lot in the house, and if you were, as a boy, exposed to two languages at the same time, English and Italian.
I was exposed to two languages, but we were brought up as American kids, and I spent my younger life, playing in the streets, every sort of street game ever devised. The last thing kids my age in those days wanted to do was to appear to be European. And to my regret, I would say that I did not master Italian as a youngster and speak only a kind of sporadic Italian now.
Do you think that hearing a lot of Italian in the house and in the neighborhood affected your ear for language in any way, even though it was something you wanted to really avoid at the time? Maybe it was even an embarrassment to you at the time.
Well, the language in my work, which is the only language that matters to me, really, is so deeply woven in consciousness that I'm not sure I can understand how it began to manifest itself. I do know that I have a curious relationship to the page. I use an old manual typewriter, largely because of the sensuous sensation of hitting the keys and watching and hearing the hammers strike the page. And I have a kind of audio-visual connection to language. That is, I'm not only aware of the rhythms of my sentences, which is something I think that characterizes my work, but I'm also conscious of the physical appearance of those alphabetic units that compose a given word. There is a relationship between certain letters that strikes me in a rather important way. And it was only recently that I was reading the afterword to a translation of the Odyssey, in which the translator Robert Fitzgerald mentions, in connection with Greek letters, the cut or sculpture of these letters, which is exactly what I respond to while I'm writing. It's a process that seems to happen automatically.
Visually, you're talking about?
Visually, yes, absolutely. Certain words will arrange themselves based in large part on the connection, the shape of the letters in those words. I might connect a word like dull with a word like lurid, which has an L, which has a D, which has a U, largely because of the visual relationship the two words have. This happens not through painstaking writing and rewriting. It tends to happen automatically.
You're very interested in the subject of celebrity and what it means in America. You wrote about that a lot in your novel, Mao, too. And you also write about that in Underworld, in the opening scene at that baseball game where the Giants win the pennant. You know, Frank Sinatra and Jackie Gleason are in the stands. And you write, the crowd uses Sinatra for a reference for everything that happens. Somebody makes a nice play, they look at Frank to see how he reacts. The beer vendor trips on a step. They look at Frank to see if he has noticed. Why do you think celebrities become reference points like that?
Someone in the book says that celebrities are the master spirits of the age. It's hard to say what it is that makes certain people more famous. Surely there's a personal magnetism. That's an important part of it. And in these days, the press of public events has become greater than it was before. And there's a kind of hunger for transcendence. And it is first and foremost the famous person, the celebrity, even the empty celebrity, who satisfies this urge. Celebrities take us out of ordinary life and into a kind of specious higher state.
Don DeLillo, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Don DeLillo recorded last October after the publication of his novel Underworld. Underworld has just been published in paperback.